So hi everyone, I'm M. Sharon Baker and welcome to our weekly Freelance Writers Den meeting. Den is the learning and support community for writers looking to grow their incomes fast. This week I'm hosting Will Fanguy of Pictochart and Allie Manning of Contently, and we're talking about infographics. I want to welcome those joining us for the first time and thank you to my returning listeners. Although this is a podcast, we do have a short slideshow, so if you're tuning in on your computer, we'll have a few slides to share. If you're just listening in, no worries, we're recording today's conversation and we'll have the audio, slideshow, transcript, and even the chat posted in the Den in a few days. To start, Will and I are going to chat for a while and then we'll spend some time taking questions from you, which you can leave in the Q&A chat window at any time. And then we'll talk with Allie and take additional questions towards the end of the hour. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Will. Will has a short bio here that Jen sent me. Says Will can speak. Whoops, where are you? Where's my script? Oh, I lost it here. Thought I in. Oh, I see what I did. Never mind. Sorry about this, people. Will can speak about. Will is a blog editor at Pictochart. There you are. He's a huge, huge nerd, apparently, fancies himself a GIF connoisseur and is pro-Oxford comma. For those of you, like me, who did not know what a pro-Oxford comma is that means it is in use as a final comma in a list of things. Some style books do not include the last comma, but Will likes to use that comma. You could tell us more about that in a minute. He is also a recovering educator, having spent most of his life teaching English to middle school students. And surprisingly, as you can see if you're viewing on the computer, he still has most of his hair. So welcome, Will.
Hi, I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on to come talk about my beliefs in different style books and comma usage.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to hear that you had to spend so much time with middle schoolers. How many years did you spend teaching English to those lovely folks?
Only about 3 years, and I tell you, middle school was my sweet spot because I am that huge nerd. A lot of my shtick and my sarcasm would be lost on high school students. They would just roll their eyes and kind of not give me the time of day, and I don't know how I would have been able to handle any more than about two or three elementary school students for more than about 5 or 10 minutes at a time. So, yeah, middle school was my sweet spot because most days they got me, and on the days that, you know, they did roll their eyes at me and kind of not care too much, and there was always at least one kid in the back that would wink and be like, yeah, I just got your Star Wars reference. Thanks, Mr. Fagy. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that person is my daughter, Anne. She always got the teacher's jokes, no matter how bad or anything is. She's just more aware than everybody else, and she would have her own little giggles. You know, it's like, ha-ha, I got that, and nobody else did. So
yeah, those are the kids you always like to connect with, because those are the ones that will eventually, if there's an uprising, be on your side.
Correct.
You know, it's sort of like a prison dynamic in there. There are so many more of them than there are of you, and you're just waiting for the day when they realize, hey, you know, we could take over if we wanted to. And luckily, you know, they're still more worried about what the kid sitting three seats down from them is saying about their hair than they are about anything else. So that's the other good thing about working with middle school students. They're more worried about themselves than they are about you.
Sure. So tell us about Pictochart and how you ended up there.
Well, Pictochart is a company that is focused on helping people tell their visual stories beautifully. We're a visual storytelling tool. We're all about creating engaging visuals, a lot of those being infographics, but we have the tools in place to help you make social media visuals and presentations and things like that. Again, most of it is infographics, but the tools and the opportunities are there for people that already know how to make. Like, if you have an idea in your head and you can draw it out on a piece of paper, but you don't necessarily have the design know-how to mess around in InDesign or Photoshop, Pictochart is there to kind of meet you in the middle to help provide the tools and the know-how and the resources necessary to kind of take the idea that you have and make it more of a reality. I got on with Pictochart back in January. Before that, I had spent about 9 months actually freelance writing and doing some consulting for web design and things like that between when I was teaching and when I started doing this. And I don't know, I really felt an immediate attraction to the company. We have a really strong company culture that's based on making sure that the employees are happy, because happy people do the best kind of work. And you know, they really give me the freedom to do the kind of work that I love, and to do things like podcast interviews and write blog posts and, you know, create great content that really gives me a chance to connect with people. And that's what my whole professional career has been about. I did public relations, and I taught, and I, you know, did some freelance work and things like that, but it's always been about communications and connecting with people, and PictoChart gives me the opportunity to do that through the role of blog editor.
So you obviously get to see a lot of good and bad infographics, I'm guessing, which is why we have you here today.
I do. I see, fortunately on my end, I get to see considerably better ones than some of the other people that hang around in our back end and get the chance to see all of the 8 million infographics that have been produced through the platform since we started about 5 years ago.
Wow, that's a long time ago. So tell us, you know, if we're going to start to create an infographic, does the writing come first? Does the graphics come first? How should someone start creating an infographic?
Well, I always look at a good infographic like I look at a good blog post or a good piece of written material. The most important steps are the ones you do before you ever even sit down at a computer or sit down in front of the tool. You've got to make sure that what you're doing is well thought out. You know, make sure you're doing your research, make sure you've got good high quality content that's going to be appealing to your audience. You know, an outline is always really helpful. Again, a lot like a really well-written blog post, just to make sure you've got the background and the information there that you need, so that you don't get what you think is about two-thirds of the way through with it and go, oh no, I don't know what to put next, or I don't know what goes here, because that's when you start making silly decisions and some visual mistakes. Also, we see a lot of people that try to do too much. You know, the opportunity and the tools are there in PictoChart to have all sorts of fonts and all sorts of colors, and we've got, I don't know, hundreds of icons in there that you can throw in and kind of add some visual flair to what you're creating. And a lot of people are like, yes, this is, you know, there's a wealth of things here that I can use. This is so great. But, you know, the key is to really try to balance your text and your images and make it more engaging than overwhelming. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right. And then is there a length of amount of words that you should keep in mind before you even start writing an infographic? Is there any kind of ideal amount of copy versus graphics?
Well, I've always kind of looked at it as, if you've got, and this again comes from my English teaching background, if you take what you would normally use as your topic sentence or your thesis in whatever paragraph or section you're using, and you take what you got and you kind of boil it down to get to the essence. You know, you always hear in presentations not to use any more than maybe, you know, what is it, maybe 10, 15 words a slide at most. And that's kind of how I look at it for each section of an infographic as well. You should make sure that you are letting the graphic part of the infographic tell as much of the story as you can. It takes the human brain processes visuals at a considerably faster rate than it processes text. So the more that you can do with graphics and icons and, you know, clip art and visual elements, the better off you are. It sounds so weird to take an outline and then expand it into a bigger piece and then distill it back down into its essence, but that's really all the text that you need, are just the high points, the bullet points, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Tell us a little bit about the bad infographics you've seen.
Oh, a lot of the bad infographics don't do that balancing very well. There's a lot of text, a lot of text. If people want to see a lot of text, or if you think that there is more text than is going to be visually appealing, that's when you come up with a blog post or an ebook or a white paper or something along those lines. A lot of it boils down to like bad layout choices, people not taking advantage of white space the way they should, giving your eyes and your brain a chance to kind of take a snapshot of what's there and have the time to process it before your eyes move on to the next thing. A lot of people taking advantage of the typography and color choices that they have. Our rule of thumb is to think of maybe not using any more than about two fonts and maybe four font varieties as far as like size or bold or italics or something like that goes, and to kind of concentrate on no more than about two or maybe three colors, preferably in a complementary fashion if you need to do more work on shades of doing them lighter or darker. A lot of the bad ones I see are not so much the content related as it is, it's just more of a bad design choices.
Mm-hmm. You know, I see a lot of infographics that are basically just a collection of statistics. Are those mm-hmm. most popular now? What do you...
Now, yeah, because that's, again, with charts and graphs, that's a really easy way to convey a large amount of information in a short amount of time because it is, again, a visual element as opposed to a giant block of text. It's one of the things that really drew me to PictoChart when I started using the tool more and more, even before I started working here, was we have a tool that will automatically import your data from either a CSV file or an Excel spreadsheet or even from a live Google Doc that'll change the graphics and the pie charts as the Google Doc itself changes. And we do have a lot of infographics that take advantage of the graphs and the charts and things like that, but also things like list posts and bulleted lists, just again short snippets, whether that's data or, you know, word-based facts. I think those are just called facts, mm-hmm. word-based facts.
And then have you come across any companies that do infographics well?
You mean like on a branding basis?
Not necessarily people using your tool, but is there some that you have in mind of, you know, like, I'm going to just throw this out, Intel, do they always do great infographics, or Coca-Cola? I'm just throwing these names out. Any companies that you recommend that people look at?
I don't have any specific brands that are always really great at infographics. I do know of at least one post we have on the blog, and while we're in the middle of taking questions here in a minute, I'll make a bit.ly link so that people can come and look at some of the greater brand-based infographics that we found. I can't think of any brands off the top of my head that always do it well. A lot of times... it's like iterating. It's the same thing with writing. You know, maybe you think it's the greatest thing you've ever done, but people might not be as drawn to it as you would hope. And then, you know, you produce this thing, you're like, you know, this is pretty good, and, you know, it goes viral, and people are always in love with it. I can't think of anybody that does it very well with regularity, but there are always just those, you know, those silver bullets that people just make, and you're just like, wow. This is a really, really well put together infographic. This is really well designed, really well balanced, and it really gets the job done.
Right. I just wondered if there was any kind of leading companies doing their own infographics that came to mind.
I see a lot more people, a lot more individuals, a lot more bloggers or smaller businesses like startups that have a content team that'll do them on a regular basis for them. I haven't seen the buy-in with large brands like you're talking about, the big, you know, the Intels and the Coca-Colas and the companies that are big like that, the big Fortune 500 companies, doing as much buy-in with infographics as I think they probably should. I think a lot of people are still stuck on some of the old ways. Not that infographics are brand new, up and coming, but I still think that they're a little more in vogue than some of the bigger, more traditional companies are willing to kind of embrace.
Right. I know I've created a couple for Microsoft just from the writing end, and we won't share them because I don't think that they're very good. They were really dense, copy-based, and I was like, I don't think that these, you know, okay, this is what you want, but I wouldn't advise this.
Right.
So I know many. I have several clients that have done infographics, and they were just way too text-based. So.
Yeah, and that's I feel like the reason that individual bloggers or smaller companies or startups have a tendency to produce the better infographics is because there are fewer layers of bureaucracy and red tape and approval that they have to go through. When I want to create an infographic to put up on the PictoChart blog, I will have a second person on the team take a look at it and make sure I don't have any horrible typos or edits or anything else, but I don't have to worry about going through the legal red tape or the, you know, making sure that there are no untoward implications like a company like, I don't know, like Facebook or Apple would have to go through if they were trying to make one.
Right, yeah. So it wouldn't be fair for us to talk about infographics without actually looking at one. So I did ask Will to send me a couple of them, and I chose the Thanksgiving one only because it was easier to portray on my screen. Will, so if you would walk us through this, and I also have snippets, so let me know in the chat box whether you guys can see this okay or whether I need to do this, which is just a snippet of each part of it. So, but you can tell us, start telling us a little bit about this infographic. It's the Thanksgiving one, Will.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it. I see your screen as well. So that's, thank you for screen sharing, even though I don't have it, even though I don't have that one particularly up here in front of me. I'll look at the image I sent you on your screen. That just seems simple enough.
Sure.
What we're looking at is essentially the same content in an infographic, just side by side. The first one not exactly being a very strong example, the second one being a considerably stronger one. Some of the different, again, I said a lot of the mistakes that people make are more design-based than content-based. A lot of people have good intentions with the content they put in, but then they get kind of carried away with some of the visual elements. A lot of things that you want to try to pay attention to are making sure that your style is consistent. Again, we have hundreds of icons for you to choose from and other images and typefaces and things like that. You want to make sure that if you've made a decision to go with a script font, you don't change to another script font later on, or if you decided you're going to go serif, you kind of stay with a serif font and only break away from that for emphasis or for visual reasons. You want to make sure that you're staying consistent with your icons and your illustrations. Also want to make sure, as we're moving down the list there on the right, that you are taking or making good use of white space, making sure that there is space for your reader's eyes to, and it sounds weird to say, but make sure that they have space to breathe. That way you're not trying to take in too much imagery or too many inputs at once. We talk about fonts again. Try not to use too many different styles once you're in there. Try not to use too many colors. Keep it simple because you don't want to overload the brain. Just because the brain can process it doesn't mean that it wants to or that it does it remarkably effectively. Just as we're going down, just make sure that you're looking at things that look visually appealing. Don't try to do too much with too little. I'm trying to scroll through your screen, then I realize that it's not my screen to control.
Oh, here, I can do, what I did is I actually did three samples talking about the top, the middle, and the bottom. Is there one you'd like to talk about?
Oh, I was moving more towards moving more towards the bottom now because I was making sure that I didn't miss anything that I wanted to hit.
Okay. You want the very bottom or the middle?
No, the very bottom would be great.
Ta-da!
There it is. Yeah, okay, so a lot of people, as good writers, we always want to make sure that we're not trying to pass off ideas that aren't ours. We want to make sure that people don't think that we're plagiarizing or coming up with things that aren't necessarily ours. So a lot of infographics that I see that are well done have footers on the bottom of them, and you want to make sure that footer isn't as visually appealing or visually attractive as the rest of the infographic. You know, we're going to make sure, just like with a footnote or an endnote little what do they call that? Not the superseded text, the little tiny text at the top. I always want to call it the exponent text, but that's because I didn't do math very well.
the tiny little, text. Just call it small.
Tiny, yeah. Superscript. That's what I'm looking for. Either the subscript or the superscript with an endnote or a footnote. You want to make sure that people know that it's there, but you don't necessarily want to make it a huge visual attraction. If you're looking to make something popular or you're looking to, have something be successful or, and I hate to use the phrase go viral because I feel like it's been done, but if you're looking for something that is going to be successful for you visually, I mean, tweets with images do get significantly more clicks, 89% more favorites, 150% more retweets. People are all about that very quick visual sort of snap. You're looking for a supplement to your original info because infographics are inherently shareable. I want to give a big shout out to Pinterest. Thank you, Pinterest, for making infographics so much easier to share via a social network now. Pinterest has been very, very successful for us both from a blogging standpoint and from a sort of getting the PictoChart, what you can do with PictoChart out there because infographics are inherently visual and Pinterest is also inherently visual. So if you're looking to kind of spread your infographics and get them out there, Twitter's great for it, but Pinterest is, I think, sort of the hidden jewel in social media that people aren't as keen to or aware of yet. It sounds so silly because my wife's been using Pinterest for her styling work for, probably a dozen years. But Pinterest, it's there. It's a thing. Check it out.
Yeah, from a business standpoint, you know, unless you really have a visual client, then they might not be on there. Like my high-tech clients really aren't on Pinterest, but they have done infographics. And I'm glad you brought up Twitter, because it seems like a lot more people are using tools like yours to even just take a quote or whatever they're putting in their box and make it graphically pleasing. I'm sure you've noticed that as well. Have you seen a great uptick in users recently?
Yeah, there's a reason that three or four of the blog posts I've published in the last couple of months are about optimizing your social media images and what the future of visual storytelling on the internet kind of looks like. Because, you know, it's one thing to kind of copy and paste a tweet, but because those visuals are so much more engaging and, you know, have the potential to be shared so much more often and with much more frequency, that people are doing things like taking those quotations out and pasting them on top of the background image. I really like Pablo by Buffer for this. Buffer is a social media management tool, and they have sort of an image creator like that named Pablo, which I absolutely love and adore. I really appreciate what PictoChart can do for those types of things, but Pablo makes it so much easier to just copy-paste a text, put a background image up there, and share it. It's not nearly as infographic-heavy, but if you're looking for a quick way to create social media visuals, especially those with quotations that you find in blog posts or in literature, Pablo is a great way to do it.
I'm just scrolling here looking to see if we have any questions. Will is going to put a link in for all those people asking if they can look at some of his graphics, including this one. We're going to post this in the den on a PDF so you can see it better. And Will said he would put a link in, a bit.ly link, which Allie has put in a Contently Pablo Buffer link here. Thank you, Allie. What questions do we have for Will? I think someone said ask something about white space for this one, because you're looking at it so small, it's really hard to see that the one does have much better white space than the other one.
I did go ahead and put in a bit.ly link for the best infographic. We did a post at the end of 2015 for the best infographics in 2015 that we found that we thought were really well done. I put a link in for that, and then I put another bit.ly link in just now that's bit.ly/new-infographics. For those of you that are kind of new to the infographic scene and are wondering where to get started, that is a link to a summary post that links out. It's kind of a hub that has some different spokes out to some of the posts that we've written in the past year or so about the best way to take the information that you have and turn it into a successful, well-designed infographic. So that's a great hub to kind of branch out and look at some of the other posts. Again, some of them are a little bit older. I'm working on going through and refreshing them right now. Our content team is myself and our marketing team leader. We're looking to expand that team here soon. So there are a lot of different tasks that kind of fall on me. Unfortunately, getting those posts refreshed and updated is not at the top of the list, but it is one of those things that I'm trying to do regularly. So please don't leave me critical comments about any grammatical or stylistic errors or incontinuities. I promise you I'm working on it.
Right. So I'm not familiar with your tool. Tell us a little bit about your site. Is it a free tool? Is it a subscription? Is it a purchase? How easy is it to use?
It is both a free tool and a subscription tool. We have a free model. We have a free mode and a pro mode. The main difference between the two is a good, considerably greater selection of templates from which to start if you work from the pro mode. That is, I think, probably our biggest plus at this point is the number of infographic templates from which you can start. I believe at last check we were somewhere between 500 and 600 different templates, which to some people sounds a bit excessive, but if you go in and you think to yourself, you know, I really know that this is something that this is the kind of direction that I want to go with it, but I'm not sure where to start, you can get into our template selector, which was literally just revamped today. We just launched a new template selector revamp today to make it a little more user-friendly, to make it a bit more of a pleasant user experience. You can go in and search for the topic that you're looking for or the type of layout that you're looking at, you know, whether it's a timeline or a summary or something like that, and there's more than likely going to be a template from which you can at least pull inspiration, if not start from scratch. my big thing with the templates and with the infographic process in general is I still kind of use my old teacher rule of beg, borrow, and steal. I don't start anything from scratch anymore, Sharon. I just don't. Mm-hmm. I find other people who have done something really well and think to myself, how can I iterate on this? How can I add my own spin to it without making it look like a blatant ripoff? Because no one wants to do blatant ripoffs.
No, but everybody starts from having an idea, and maybe somebody else's idea has informed their idea. We even do that in writing, so
yeah.
Why can't Absolutely. We do graphics?
No, that's the whole thing. And you start with a general idea that somebody has, and you start simple. You know, you take that outline that you've got, you find one of the templates that we have. We started doing some more less focused on particular topics and more just general, well-designed, well-laid-out, good color choices, good typography choices with some of the templates we've been doing here the past couple of months. You just go in and you start simple. You use your outline and you say, okay, here's what this template has in this block. Here's the icons they've used, the fonts they've used. How can I make a couple of little tweaks and a couple of small changes to really make this mine? And that's really, in my opinion, all there is to it, is just starting with one of those templates and kind of making it yours. Now, I mean, down the road there are, I mean, we have a rather expansive feature set. I know I'm all sorts of biased, and I hope that comes across. I hope that people don't think for one second that I'm not biased. I am. I think our tool is great, and I love all of the things that you can do with it. But, I mean, there are text frames. There are maps. You've got the graphs and the charts I talked about. You can embed videos so that you've got, if you're sharing it online instead of in person, it's more of an interactive infographic. It's very easy to get overwhelmed, so if you go in and just start simple with one of the templates and work from there, you're bound to have a pretty high level of success. But, you know, I think that, especially with some of the things we have in the pipeline that I'm not officially allowed to talk about, I think that the possibilities are endless as far as visual storytelling and graphic creation goes. Even if you're somebody who has little to no design experience whatsoever, we make it, in my opinion, relatively easy to kind of go from nothing to something in a very short amount of time. And if you find out that is not the case, I will encourage you to tweet at me or email me, because I want to, I like connecting with people. My job is to kind of help you make the tool more effective for you. So, you know, seriously, if I'm not right and it's not as easy as I'm making it out to be, call me out on it and let me help you.
Right.
That's my thing. Like, I don't want to be like, oh, yeah, this is great, because, you know, sometimes you get caught in that technology bubble where you think, oh, I use this tool every day. It's super easy for me. And then somebody new, like my wife, goes to use it, and she's not exactly sure how to do this. And you're like, oh, I should probably toss that to the user experience researchers so we can find out a cleaner, more streamlined way to make it work. So if you don't think it's easy, have a little bit of a problem, please not hesitate to contact me or customer.
Will, you're starting to break up on us here. That last part, you're kind of, I don't know, bebopping. I didn't hear what you said, but we do have one question that I'd like you to answer. One person says, say I wanted to write an article on saving for a big trip. As a new infographic creator, how would you recommend I start?
Well, I know that there are templates that are dedicated to travel. I know that there are templates that are dedicated to budgeting. If you go to that bit.ly link that I put up there, it's bit.ly/newinfographics, I believe that there's a blog post in there that talks about the 8 different types of infographics. Now, obviously, you can kind of spin off of that and do small variations on those 8, but I would say start there and say, okay, am I more focused on the travel part? Am I more focused on the budget part? And now that I've got that idea in mind, does this best fit with a timeline? Does this best fit with this style of infographic? And then once you have that style in mind, kind of go to the template selector and say, okay, I know in general what my theme is. I know in general what direction I want to go with it. Now here's this collection of templates. I wonder if there's something in here that can help me. I'm going to preach the gospel of templates constantly.
Yeah, if you don't have an artistic background or graphic design background, I think that's the way to go. Then you don't make common mistakes that make your infographic end up in our bad pile versus our good pile, so to speak. So thank you, Will. I don't know if you'd like to stay for the next half an hour. You can, while we're talking to Allie, and we might have some questions at the end. I don't know if we will or not, but whatever
I am. I would love to, but I am absolutely slammed with the things I'm going today. I'm going to answer questions about copyright and training videos in the chat, but I know that you have Allie that you want to get to, so I'll kind of turn the microphone off so you don't hear the clicking, and then I'll slowly fade into the darkness as
okay.
though I came, bestowed my knowledge, and left.
All right. Well, thank you for being here today. We really appreciate it, and we're learning a lot about infographics, obviously, from you. So thanks for sharing with us today.
Absolutely.
All right. Allie, I am going to...
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. Let me introduce you to the crew.
Sure.
Allie is a senior manager of Contently's Creative Network, overseeing freelance writers and designers who create, among other things, infographics for clients. Before joining the Contently team, am I saying that right? I always say it that way, Contently.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
She was a strategic digital manager of brand development for Condé Nast International, overseeing projects, for Vogue, Glamour, and GQ websites. She also launched an intranet to improve communication among the different geographic and project groups. For those of you who had questions in the chat, Allie's going to talk about what clients are looking for in an infographic writer and what makes freelance writers successful doing so. So welcome, Allie, again.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed the first half infinitely.
So tell us a little bit about what you do in the world of infographics.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I head up the freelance network here at Contently. We have a free portfolio tool for freelance writers and creatives of all walks of creativity. And we use those portfolios, if you give us permission, we use those to take to our clients and assign you to paying projects. And via our tool or our platform, we then pay our creatives via PayPal upon submission of a first draft. So no more invoicing and waiting around to be paid. Everything's kind of handled right there from the screen. So our writers really enjoy that, and so do our designers. Another kind of facet of the Contently platform is our pitching feature. And what that does is basically allow clients to request pitches from their team or pool of freelance writers that the talent team assigns to them. So that's really where I think the huge an opportunity is for freelance writers, is pitching infographics. And I can go into more detail, but I will turn it back to you.
Oh, that's okay. Tell us about pitching infographics. I didn't know that you guys had that feature.
Yeah, so what we found when I started this job a little over a year ago was that pitches were kind of the key to the client's heart. Because we work with brands who are not necessarily, you know, native publishers, they are slightly lacking in terms of editorial direction and ideas. So when we're able to give them writers who have these ideas and who have creative angles on certain topics that they want to cover, they're infinitely more happy with both us and their editorial team. So then we started seeing this huge kind of trend of infographics becoming really, really popular. And we had plenty of designers, but we didn't have any writers who were specifically trained in writing copy for infographics. And we found that the writers who applied themselves to this kind of new medium were cleaning up, basically, because all the clients wanted infographics. And the writers who were pitching them were getting almost every pitch that they submitted approved and accepted and commissioned. So pitching an infographic as a writer is a unique skill, and it's a lucrative one in my experience.
So we always love to hear about the lucrative part first. So tell us, what can you make writing an infographic? What rates can you expect?
Boy, okay. So, well, Contently's pay structure is tied very closely to word count, except for infographics. In infographics, because obviously the point is to keep the copy short so that the visuals can tell the story, The way we price them out is based on your sourcing. So if it's a primary source or five primary sources or maybe it's 12 secondary sources, we pay more for the more research that's required. So if you're just simply gathering statistics from around the internet, that's one price. I think infographic pay starts around $250, and that would be for something very straightforward. So the top five lipstick manufacturers in the U.S., for example, and you can find that information on the internet. So that would probably go for about $250. This can go all the way up to, boy, $950, $1,000 if you're actually crunching data yourself and essentially creating new statistics. So depending on the complexity of gathering the data, you can make anywhere from $250 to $900, really. And also, of course, depending on the number of data points that you're going to be eventually handing in.
So when you talk about the, maybe let's talk about kind of the middle of the road price, is there a certain number of data points you need to have? And maybe there's just a basic. So, yeah, tell us about that.
So the number one piece of advice is when you're working with a client, obviously study and scrutinize the style guide. Make sure that you know you're not wasting your time or spinning your wheels, you know, pitching an infographic that isn't something that the client would be interested in. So if the client says they have a really snappy, millennial kind of buzzfeedy tone, then you're probably going to want to pitch something that's a little briefer, maybe 5 to 6 copy points or something. And then maybe if you're pitching to, you know, Goldman Sachs, you're going to pitch 12 to 13 copy points. And so it's all relative to the client to whom you're speaking. And, you know, it's important to be able to interpret that style guide and kind of try and translate it to be most ripe for approval, as it were.
Let's take a step back and talk about sourcing for a minute. When you're talking about sourcing, I know there are different levels, but some of our listeners might. So tell us about the different level of sources that you've encountered and the problems that you run into with some of them.
Okay, so obviously a primary source is when you get the info straight from the horse's mouth. So if you're writing an infographic about mortgages and you schedule an interview with Billy Bob, the head of mortgages at JP Morgan Chase, interviewing Billy Bob can easily be made into an infographic. I mean, an infographic can really be anything. So if you're able to kind of chop that interview up into some interesting facts that kind of tell a story, that's a primary source. And obviously that requires more effort than simply Googling, you know, top 5 tips for saving for a mortgage, for example.
Right.
So that would be more of a secondary source. And then the third kind of data thing is essentially finding your own data. But then we're sort of going into data journalism, and again, that is an extremely lucrative avenue for freelance writers. I'm going to go ahead and pop the link into the chat right now, which I find really useful. It's kind of sources for writers to find data for free. So some writers will go into this data and dig around, see if they can find anything interesting, and then write a pitch based on that. Or perhaps you have a theory in your head. Boy, I think, you know, boys named Steve make more money than boys named Fred. And then they'll go research that, and if they do find a correlation, they can kind of pitch or formulate an infographic around that data. So there are plenty of sources where you can find data to include in your infographics, and those are the most lucrative because those are new facts. Those are things that nobody else has noticed before. So you can definitely charge more, essentially.
Right. And there are tons and tons of people citing other people when they do things.
Yeah.
I write a lot of B2B content, and I'm always running across somebody who's citing something and has a link, but it's really somebody else that's quoting somebody else that's quoting
that's
not even true sometimes. So,
right. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
So I was just trying to kind of get you to that area in terms of you always have to look for primary sources. Even when you're writing blog posts and you're trying to get a statistic or something, you should always investigate your statistic and make sure that statistic that you're using is actually correct and applicable. Because
absolutely.
I think the one big one I ran across recently is people talk about B2B buyers being 75% through the buying process before they'll even contact your company, and that is a false statistic that just keeps getting repeated and repeated and repeated. And I don't have it on my secondary computer here, but I did end up finding out where that came from. And it was like, oh, great, I think I've been guilty of that myself, you know, just one of those things that people take on and glom on, and all of a sudden, when somebody else questions it, you're like, oh, no.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, frankly, you have one reputation as a freelance writer, and if you're not, if you do get caught, essentially, not being as diligent as you should be with citing those data sources, you know, you stand to lose a lot of clout and reputation, and therefore, you know, money. So it's really important, really, really important.
I did want to point out that I'm sure that Billy Bob at Goldman Sachs actually makes the most money.
Sorry, when I get nervous, as one might tend to be on a live podcast, I come up with the most ridiculous illustrative stories and examples. I don't know where – it's my father's fault. I think it's his fault. He's done this to me.
I've used Billy Bob, too, all the time. So. It just has a nice ring to it.
It does. It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. I'm sure there's probably a Billy Bob on TV that we've both seen, because I actually don't know any Billy Bobs in person.
Yeah, neither do I. Neither do I, Sharon. That's what else can I weigh in on?
So I'm not a member of your site. So actually, obviously, to pitch you, you have to be a member of your site. I'd like to make that clear, correct?
Sure. Yes, that is correct.
And
contently.com/register.
And you do have creative briefs that or guidelines that people can access? How would I do that on your platform? I haven't heard of that before.
Sure. So the way it works is essentially you create a portfolio on that register link that I've just posted, and the computer will, once you've added a certain number of clips and a certain number of publications that are in high editorial standing, the robots that Contently have built will essentially flag your portfolio to my team, the talent team, and someone will go in and actually read your work and take in your portfolio, very much like submitting a resume. And if there's a client that has a fit with your general expertise, we will write to you, send you some training for how to use our platform, which takes about 10 minutes. And I wrote it myself, so it's hilarious if I do say so. And once you're trained and matched up, and we essentially put you on a client's team, and then from there it goes in two directions. Either the client will ask you to pitch ideas to them, and they'll give you parameters. They'll say, you know, we want 500 words on ducks this quarter, or, you know, by the end of the week, and you can choose to pitch or decline to pitch. It's up to you. You're a freelancer. Or they will actually give you an assignment, and they'll say, you know, we need this white paper, 3,000 words, pay is $2,500, it's on B2B tech and data security. And you can either accept or decline that assignment, and off you go. So, I'd say the majority of the assignments of the work that we dole out to over 3,500 freelancers we work with is pitch-based. So if you can come up with if you know how to pitch well, and if you're not, a lot of writers I've noticed, especially those who've been around a while, are very opposed to pitching because, you know, they've built up a reputation, and I understand that. But when you're looking at the content marketing game, it's pretty important to be okay with pitching and to be really good at it, because it's, like I said, for other reasons, for brands, it's just it's necessary, you know.
So do most of those brands that you're working with, they don't have a content strategist that says, okay, I need, you know, I'm writing to Billy Bob, and he's an engineer, no longer at Goldman Sachs, and we want to get him enticed to buy whatever product it is. So you're not working with those types of companies? That's who I work generally with, this content strategist. So I'm just trying to understand and kind of educate myself and everybody else.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we basically, every account that we have, all of our clients, have what we call a brand editor. And they are fellow freelancers. They're rigorously trained by our Contently head of enterprise services, who's a very gifted editor himself. And essentially, they will run the publication. And they will be the ones who say, okay, we want, you know, 3,000 words on XYZ and 7,000 words on this and that. And they're the ones who also kind of approve, accept, or decline pitches. Most of the clients we work for are very dedicated to content marketing, and as a result, there aren't a lot of projects that are kind of boring marketing copy. You know, these are fairly editorial topics that we cover. And, you know, our recommendation to our clients is to never, in fact, mention your brand's name in any of your content, because when you do that, you lose authenticity and the respect of your audience. So it's a great platform if you have an editorial background and you want to, you know, do quality journalism. It's very much not a content farm. And whilst there are pillars and guidelines around what you should be pitching and what sort of content they want, it's really up to you.
So go back to that statistic, because I'm not sure I heard it correctly, and I'd like to hear it again in terms of the amount of content that is assigned versus pitched.
Right. I would say the split is roughly 80% pitched and 20% assigned. What I see happen is, you know, we put 5 tech writers on a new account, for example, IBM. And the 5 writers, you know, each pitch a few times, they get a few assignments, they prove that they're good at what they do and they produce good content, and then the managing editor, the brand editor on that account, will assign them stories based on their strengths. So it's kind of like you pitch at the beginning so that you get to know the person and you prove that you're invested and produce quality content, and then you'll get an assignment, you know, that's very spelled out.
And is that different than when you started?
I don't think so, no. Well, actually, you're right. That's a good point. We definitely have increased the value or increased the visibility of the pitching process since I started about a year ago.
And then, so I know we've gotten a little bit off track, so I'm going to go back to infographics,
yes.
And if you still have time, I'll come back to my question if I remember it.
Okay.
But so if I'm interested in writing infographics and I don't really have a big portfolio, how do I get in front of you to say, hey, I'd like to write infographics, and I might have some good ideas, but I don't have a huge portfolio, or I have a portfolio of ugly infographics that the client wanted. Like in my case, I have like copy dense ones that I've written, but I don't think they're great. But the client wanted them like that, and so whatever the client, you know, wanted, I just didn't.
Of course.
Them, of course.
Of course, that's what we do. So that is tricky. That's very tricky, but good question. So with Contently, because our clients pay us, you know, a fair bit of money, and we pay our writers a fair bit of money, you do have to kind of get through that first hurdle with your background. We don't take on people who, for example, just graduated from college and haven't really written for anyone. Until you've written for some prestigious publications and you can put those on your portfolio and get past the robots and get past the human vetters, frankly, there isn't a way for you to raise your hand at the moment. We have 95,000 portfolios, and so, you know, we need a way to cut through the fat. That sounds very ruthless. I do not mean it to sound that way, but, you know, we're only a team of four, and we're doing the best we can to kind of make sure we find everyone that's good. But the reality is that, you know, you've got to kind of meet those minimum standards to be able to pitch to our clients.
Okay. And tell us, you know, just in general, who are your clients these days?
Sure. Amex Open Forum is probably our flagship client. JP Morgan Chase we work with. Mostly we work with tech and finance clients. Other than that, we have Walmart on the book, so we write some content for their lifestyle line. We work with Avocados of Mexico. That's a fun new client that we've just signed, and we create recipes and cool stuff for them. Let me look here. Who else is cool? IBM is a client. I'm drawing a blank due to the live and nervous nature of this.
That's okay. I did that for 20 minutes last week.
But everyone can check out contently.com and see all of our clients there.
So you might be able to answer a question. So I actually have a portfolio up there, but it was just a whole bunch of varied journalism links. And I know we've talked about, we actually put you in the content mill bucket, because everybody's, I think, starting to redefine themselves. And a lot of our, I'll just say a handful, because I don't really know, of our members have said, yeah, I've never gotten any assignments from Contently, even though my portfolio is up there. You know, I think I used it as an alternative place for putting up some of my journalism clips while I took another route with my own website and put up more of my, you know, business clips, white papers, case studies, you know, blog posts, that kind of stuff. So you mentioned that you work with about 3,500 writers out of 95,000. Is that what you're telling me?
That's correct, yeah.
So that kind of at least tells many of our listeners that, you know, unless, don't just sign up unless you have a strong portfolio.
I have, yes. I mean, yes. There are several responses to that. The first one is, you know, our clients are who our clients are. So if you could be the most gifted sports writer on the planet, but we have no need for you at the moment because we don't have any clients who are covering sports beats. So that's one thing. That's why some people who perhaps cover, I don't know, downtown Austin travel. We don't have any clients that are writing about that, so we probably haven't reached out to you, which is frustrating, but that's the nature of the business. The other thing is, the portfolio tool was set up in such a way before I arrived at Contently that was very sort of unstrategic, for lack of a better term. People filled out the portfolio and they wrote in their bio section, you know, oh, I've worked for Forbes and I've worked for this and I've worked for that. But the reality is they should have been instructed to list their areas of expertise in that bio section. So that bio section on the top left of your Contently portfolio should say things like real estate, home finance, risk management, buyer's insurance, all those things. It should list the topics that you cover rather than be a true bio. It's called the bio section. It should be called the expertise section. So essentially, unless you optimize your portfolio so that we can find you, you know, we won't find you, frankly. So I've just put a link into the chat that says contently.com/optimize, and that will actually walk you through how to make sure we can see you when we search for you. I do think it's a tragedy that there are so many talented writers out there that we haven't been able to find, but you know, unless the portfolio is set up and done in such a way that we can find you, there's little we can do. So definitely have your members go check out that Optimize link, and we can hopefully find them when we need them.
Right. So we're going to take some questions from chat. Thanks for leaving them there. Audience. I don't know what I was going to say. Yes. Who are you? You're my listeners. Sorry about that. Allie, but quickly tell us in terms of the lucrative gigs that you have on Contently, what is kind of a starting rate for projects? And you said you are mostly based on word count. Maybe you can tell us how much you generally pay a word, or you know, kind of what flat fees can someone expect for like a blog? And are you mostly blog posts? Or are you also white papers, case studies?
Yeah. We do all of it. White papers we charge based on the vertical of the topic. So vertical one or category one would be anything lifestyle, travel, traditionally more fluffy. That's not the right word, but anyway, you know what I mean.
Featurey,
topic. Yeah, featurey. And then topic or vertical two is B2C finance, business, entrepreneurship, leadership, that kind of stuff, that kind of middle range. And then the third tier is B2B, anything enterprise tech, software, anything that requires sort of a high level of expertise is in that area, and the blog posts for tier one start at $255. Then tier two is $450, and tier three goes up to $600, and that's for a 500 to 700 word blog post with secondary sources. And then it goes up. If a primary source is required, we add a couple $100s to each of those prices, depending on the tier. So, and then it goes all the way up to white papers or ebooks, which are roughly 85 cents a word for tier one, $150 a word for tier two, and $3 for tier three. So depending on how intense the expertise is, we pay more money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thanks for sharing those.
Sure. Happy to. I am of the belief that our prices should be public. The problem with that is that some clients pay more or less than those. They are not standard across all our clients. So we're unable to tell writers, oh, yeah, you can earn this much money. Those are our guidelines.
Well,
try not to go under.
We're a closed membership site, so we'll try to keep those, you know, in-house.
Yes, please.
So there's a great bonus for all of my listeners today.
Yes,
hey, let's get back to infographics. I'm sorry, we've kind of got off that track a little bit. But Tracy asks, do you actually fact check on the deliverables with the infographics?
Our editors will fact check. Obviously, you will have to source and provide links to your sources for everything that you submit. And, you know, the Emmys or the editors, they will fact check as best they can. But again, it's really kind of your reputation to lose. And, it's very important to make sure that you're doing your own fact checking as well.
Right. Unfortunately, it doesn't looks like we have a whole bunch of questions regarding just to writing for you. So if do you have a couple more minutes or no?
Let me just check. I'm in a conference room at the office, and let me just see if somebody else is going to come barging in any minute. Hang on one second.
Sure.
If not,
we can do another podcast
next week or something like that.
So let's just take a couple, and maybe we'll just go to 12:10 if you have another 7 minutes or so.
Okay. Yes.
So one person asks, is there a magic number of clips on a portfolio that triggers the robots to notice?
That's a great question, Evan. there is, but you can't tell anyone that I've told you. It's 5 publications minimum, and minimum of 8 clips.
Okay.
I
was just going to go rapid fire unless you wanted to say something.
No, go ahead.
Linda says her clips are old, and the ones I have after the internet kicked in a small. Don't know what that means. Most of my clips were proprietary and I can't share. How do I get around that?
That is indeed very tough. You are able to upload PDFs to your portfolio. But frankly, you know, if what you're submitting hasn't been written in the last 3 to 5 years, you know, 5 years, it's probably not as relevant and won't score you as high with the robots. And how you get around the proprietary stuff, when you upload a clip uncontently, there is a way to edit the description of text underneath the clip. So if you've ever ghostwritten something, always upload it and then write in the description, this was ghostwritten by myself in, you know, this date and this date. And that way we know that you're not just a crazy person posting links to things that you never wrote. There has to be a way for you to flag that these are in fact your work and they were ghostwritten. Another tip for ghostwriters is to use the term ghostwriter or ghostwriting in that bio section. That way, when we're searching, we might actually even search for the term ghostwriting and you'll come up.
And then in addition to clips, do these all have to be newspaper or magazine or web clips, or can they be things like B2B white papers, case studies, blah, 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 blah?
B2B white papers and case studies are amazing. In fact, those are better than the others. That's what our clients want. We're having the trickiest time finding technical white paper writers. So if there's anything of that nature that you can upload, please do.
And then you can easily, like all my clips up there are journalism, because I thought that's, you kind of had a brand journalism bet.
Mm-hmm.
But I fall into that tier 3, $3 a word range, because I write white papers and case studies all the time for large enterprise technology companies. So thinking, oh, that might not be bad. And I guess we didn't answer what the cut is. That's just our price. We don't pay. You put the fee on top, right? You don't take the fee out of that.
We take 15%, and frankly, that's a pass-on cost just to pay for PayPal, and we actually don't make a lot of money from the marketplace or from the content. We actually make our money from subscription software as a service. We're a SaaS model company, so we take our money from the clients. So those prices would be to you, but again, they're guidelines, and every client is a little bit different.
Right. And then I'm just asking for me here, when we post something to your portfolio, is that proprietary that everybody can't see, or is that kind of a public profile?
They are public. But you can only really find, they're not indexed anywhere, so you could never go on Contently and search for Sharon Baker. That we don't have the functionality to do that. You could probably Google Contently Sharon Baker and find your portfolio. So the answer is you can't search them as a rule, But if you know someone has a portfolio and Google has done its thing properly, then you can probably find who you're looking for.
Okay.
But for the most part, to be honest, unless the writer themselves promotes their portfolio themselves, really the only people looking at it are going to be me, my team, and our clients.
Right. Yeah. Debbie says, I have 60 magazine clips in a private neighborhood publication and 8 or so newspaper creds. How do I get infographic experience? And perhaps she has in a comment aside, and shouldn't I bother? Maybe. She's not sure, of course. Yeah.
No, I think, Debbie, I think you absolutely should. It depends on, you know, what you write about. Newspaper creds and neighborhood publications. I mean, we do have clients who write about real estate, so if, you know, I don't know what exactly your expertise is in, but I would apply, I would create a portfolio either way. It's a useful tool, and there's always a chance. And how do you get infographic experience? The answer to that is to, pitch infographics to clients. That's the number one thing to do.
Right, and so you can do that as a freelance writer. I know someone had this question a long time ago, how you would use these clips. And, as you're regular working with different clients, you can say, I have this idea, let's do an infographic.
Yeah.
If we were doing that, and I noticed, of course, we totally have moved away from my slideshow where we were going to talk about two infographics that I have here.
Yeah.
Kind of got sidetracked. But if we were, help us figure out a pricing. If I was going to say, okay, I think I can create this infographic for a client,
uh-huh.
I have no idea what I should price for it in terms of, we usually say flat fee pricing.
Uh-huh.
In general, what are clients paying for? What do they expect to pay for an infographic? And this probably would be, I'd have to either use a tool like Pictograph or hire a designer. So kind of what does that overall price look like?
Sure.
And then what does the writing portion look like?
Right. So at Contently, we do them two things separately. Someone writes it and someone designs it. We have professional designers that make probably, for the one that's on the screen now, that probably costs the client about $2,000.
Okay.
And I'm just guessing right now. And the designer would make about $1,200 or $1,300 of that, and the writer would probably make between $300 and $400 of that.
Okay.
And then the 15% to Contently for the banking fees and all that jazz. So, yeah, I mean, I can't really read exactly what's in this infographic because I didn't do that beforehand. I should have. But if, for example, each of these little bits of text are, you know, brand new insights never before published, that price would go up. But I'm guessing that these are all secondary source.
Yeah, these were just regular statements about buying a house. So.
Yeah.
And then quickly, if you still have a minute or two, because I have it on my slideshow, your bad example of an infographic, which is the whole thing is on the left, which was too long for me to put on my slide. So I think I know what you're going to say, but why don't you address that just so that we have it for our recording?
Yep. Yep. You are probably very aware. It's obviously too much text. There's no, you know, I know when a writer sits down to compose a masterpiece, you talk about the narrative arc. There is also something called a visual arc. The example beforehand, you know, the eye is very easily led throughout the text. The point of an infographic is for the pictures to lead your eye across the page so that you can download this information in a soothing and pleasing way. This infographic we're looking at on the screen here is extremely stunted. It's far too much text. It's actually more of an article with icons in it, frankly.
Right.
So I think that this was pretty poorly executed. So think about when you're pitching an infographic as a writer, I would never, I mean, I know Will's tool is very clever and PictoChart is amazing and I enjoy it very much, but in terms of pitching an infographic as a writer, I would always just pitch the text and leave it to the client to find a designer. A lot of clients are very particular about their visual style. I wouldn't produce something on spec. I would pose the idea, and then if the client's interested and they want to commission it, then maybe you go find a designer or you have a go at PictoChart. But I would keep the two fairly separate. Stick to what you're good at and crafting the words, really.
Great. Thank you, Allie. You've kind of provided us way more information than I was expecting.
I know. I apologize. Contently is a maze, but it's a very good maze. So I hope that everyone signs up for a portfolio and drop me an email and tell me you've done so, and I'll make sure that I raise your portfolio up to the top. I've also put a job listing on the Writer's Den job post list, just in case anyone needs an extra bit of information. And yeah, I hope to kind of partner with you guys a bit more closely going forward.
Sure, we might like that. I'll mention something to Carol because she's the arbitrator of things since it's her site.
Great. Great.
So
great. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And our upcoming podcasts are taking a break in September. Apparently, we are going to have a writing improvement lab next Thursday, September 8th already. I don't have a calendar in front of me, but apparently it might be. And then we're going to start a mini boot camp, so that will take place of our podcast. So I will not be speaking at you all until October. So happy Labor Day, I guess. Happy beginning of school. Two of mine have already started school. Thanks for joining us today and to our guests for allowing us to go over a little bit. So thanks again, Allie and Will, and we will all see you in the den.
Thank you.
Thanks.